Well, I've been asked to provide an introductory overview to some of the dynamo models that have been used to interpret and explain the sun's magnetic activity cycle. Dynamo models for the global magnetism of the sun. A reasonable place to begin such a discussion is by briefly reviewing some of the properties with which any such theory has to cope. In view of the fact that many of the preceding speakers have spoken exhaustively of these very same properties, I'll rapidly go through exhaustively. The first and most obvious manifestation of the sun's magnetic activity cycle is the cyclic variation in the number of spots present on the disk. If spots are the result of upwellings of toroidal flux from deep inside the sun, then the increase and decrease of spots present on the disk is telling us something about the process of intensification that the toroidal field is undergoing over the course of the solar cycle. The work of Hale and others revealed that spots tend to emerge in pairs, roughly along a line, an east-west line on the surface of the sun. The pairs are comprised of spots of opposite magnetic polarity, and the sense of magnetic orientation between spot pairs in one hemisphere and the opposite are the opposite of one another and reverse between cycles. This is telling us something about the symmetry, the large-scale symmetry of the toroidal magnetic field, in particular that the field must be anti-symmetric about the equator. The spottedness of the sun varies with latitude during the course of the solar cycle. New spots emerge at the beginning of the cycle at latitudes between 30 and 35 degrees or so, and then propagate poleward, equatorward during the course of the cycle. The solar cycle, at least insofar as the toroidal field and the spots present on the surface, is a migrating phenomenon, propagating from the pole to the equator over the course of the cycle. Finally, the large-scale poloidal field of the sun is also anti-symmetric about the equator. It's been known since 1959 that the polarity of the polar fields, the polar poloidal fields, reverses. It reverses just about the time of sunspot maximum or shortly thereafter, and it reverses in the sense that it adopts the polarity of the following spots of that current cycle. We also learned this morning that the sun is not the only example of cyclic magnetic activity. It's known in the case of the sun that the emission core and the core of the calcium K-line varies in strength during the course of the sun's magnetic activity cycle, and that the K-line emission is more intense in more highly magnetized regions. And those characteristics have been used to try and look for and track magnetic activity cycles in stars other than the sun. And here are two examples from the campaign started by Hull and Wilson in the middle 60s and carried out to the present day of nearly solar-like, in this case a direct solar analog, stars that show variability in the core of the calcium K-line, which presumably is a result of varying magnetic activity over a cycle with a period that's roughly 10 years in both of these cases. Well, these are the general attributes of the sun's time-dependent magnetic field, and probably one of the great problems confronting modern astrophysical science is identifying the mechanism or mechanisms that are responsible for producing these changes. What exactly is the process by means of which the sun's time-dependent magnetic field is generated and maintained? Well, the approach that's been adopted, and which I'll adopt today, is that it's the product of a dynamo. We know that moving conductors and current systems can give rise to time-varying magnetic fields. a mechanical generator or dynamo is in effect a device for converting mechanical energy to electromagnetic energy by electromagnetic induction. And the assumption we make with regard to the magnetic fields of the sun and the stars is that their fields are generated and maintained by a hydromagnetic dynamo, that the fluid of which the sun and the stars is composed is electrically conducting, and that motions within those fluid bodies are capable of regenerating and sustaining magnetic fields within those stars. Well, that being the case, then, a reasonable place to start to study the magnetism of the sun and the stars is with the induction equation in the MHD approximation, which the electric field has been replaced by, in this case, in CGS units, minus 1 over CV cross B plus 1 over the electrical conductivity times the electric current. The problem of the regeneration of the solar magnetic field can basically split into two considerations. How do you maintain the toroidal field, and how do you then subsequently create a colloidal field? With respect to the toroidal field, the answer is relatively obvious in the sense that if the internal velocity field of the sun is assumed to be purely rotational, that is, the fluid velocity is in the azimuthal direction with some angular velocity which varies with position inside the sun, then substitution in the induction equation indicates that the a source of toroidal field is just the action of that non-uniform rotation on an existing poloidal field. So if the sun is permeated by a pre-existing poloidal field, and if the interior of the sun is in a state of non-uniform rotation, then that shear can act on the colloidal field to generate a toroidal field. I think the essence of much of dynamo theory is how to then subsequently regenerate and maintain the colloidal field. The answer is not so obvious, and in the early days of the subject, it was even less obvious in the light of so-called anti-dynamo theorems due to Cowling and Bullard and Gell-Mann, wherein it was pointed out that an axisymmetric field could not be maintained by purely axisymmetric fluid motions, that a field could not be maintained in a body if the only motion present in the fluid was a pure rotation. And the answer, I think, to the question of how the colloidal field was generated was in fact given by Parker, first in 1955, and then subsequently in a series of papers beginning in 1970, wherein he kind of formalized much of what we regard as modern dynamo theory. What he did was he realized that the outer 25 or 35% of the sun is convective, and that magnetic lines of force in that highly conducting, convecting fluid would be frozen to the fluid, that the motion of a fluid element with an entrained magnetic field due to convection would be twisted as a result of the Coriolis force acting on the fluid. And he explained this. This is a quote from a paper in 1970. The mechanism is simple. The Coriolis forces on the convection cause it to be cyclonic, with a rising cell of fluid rotating and carrying the lines of force of the azimuthal field into loops with a non-vanishing projection on the meridional plane. A large number of such loops coalesce to regenerate the dipole field. This is the effect that we now currently call the alpha effect. And you can see kind of how it works in this little cartoon. Imagine that you have a uniform field in a conducting fluid so that the field lines are tied to the fluid motions. If an element of fluid is subjected to an upward rise and expansion, as might be expected if the fluid was convecting, then a rotation of the system in this direction will impart a helicity to the fluid. It will twist it, cause it to become what Parker called cyclonic. In the case of the sun, in the northern hemisphere of the sun, it's easy to convince yourself that the relative orientation of the sun's angular velocity vector and a radially moving, expanding convective element is such as to give the element a negative vorticity, which gives it a negative kinetic helicity, which twists the field line in such a way as to make a positively directed current along the field. So the field line is twisted into a loop whose plane is perpendicular to the direction of the pre-existing field, or equivalently, a current has been made which is along the field. Well, this is the so-called alpha effect, and much work has been expended since Parker's 1955 paper to formalize that into a theory. I won't go through all the details of this, but simply point out that the formal theory is known today as mean field electrodynamics, and its derivation consists of, once again, starting with the induction equation, the MHD approximation, but making the assumption that the fields are all separable into a sum of an average and a fluctuating component. The averaging process can be spatial or temporal or regarded as an ensemble average, but the important property is that the averages of the fluctuating quantities themselves vanish. If these substitutions are made in the induction equation, the equation can be split into an average piece and a piece for the turbulent component of the fields. And under certain conditions, homogeneity in the sense that average quantities derived from the turbulent field are translation invariant, and isotropy in the sense that the same quantities are rotationally invariant, but not reflectional symmetry, that they're not mirror symmetric, this turbulent electromotive force that acts as a source term for the large-scale mean field can be written in this particularly simple form. So here, again, the electromotive force is proportional to the current that we saw in the preceding slide, and it's related linearly to the mean field via this pseudo-scalar, because it's not reflectionally symmetric, alpha. It's from this quantity that the alpha effect derives its name. In principle, it's possible to make some additional assumptions regarding the nature of the turbulent flow and magnetic fields to actually begin to derive approximate results for what alpha is. In the subsequent slides that I'll show you, I'm simply going to assume that alpha is a specifiable quantity that, in accord with what we think is a possible physical origin for it within the sun, that in the sun's northern hemisphere it ought to be positive, in the southern hemisphere it ought to be negative, and that the substitution of this result into the dynamo equation results in this mean field dynamo equation, which is kind of the fundamental equation used to derive dynamo models, which within this formalism of mean field electrodynamics. In the results that I'm going to show you, the dynamos will always be considered to be kinematic in the sense that we're going to prescribe the velocity fields and not derive them consistently using the dynamical equations that go along with the induction equation. But the important thing to remember about this approach to dynamo theory, about mean field electrodynamics in particular, is that the theory describes the generation of a large-scale mean field as a result of turbulent interactions in small-scale fluctuating fields. That it's a a description of a process by means of which the large-scale field is maintained and regenerated through the collective action of small-scale fluctuating fields. Well, here's a simple example of how this might work. Just a one-dimensional dynamo in which the X, Y, and Z Cartesian directions correspond to the theta, phi, and r directions in spherical coordinates. The field is composed of just a a toroidal component, which is y-directed in this formalism, and a poloidal component, which is in the z-direction and is derivable from as the curl of a vector potential that is itself toroidally directed, in a limit in which the alpha effect is in some sense weak in comparison to the shear generation of toroidal field. The equations can be written in this simple form, and we can solve them on an interval in latitude, because the x-coordinate is associated with latitude, subject to boundary conditions which pick out the anti-symmetric solution with an alpha effect distribution in latitude, which is varies like we expect the Coriolis force to vary. But if you solve the model, you find this kind of behavior. The solid line is the toroidal field. The dashed line is the one poloidal field component. This is a time series of how the field varies sinusoidally at a point along the domain that corresponds to a latitude of 30 degrees. If you look at the fields as within the entire X domain, that is, here's the North Pole, here's the South Pole, and this would be the equator, you can see that maxima, in this case, in the solid line in the toroidal field, propagate over time toward the equator. As they propagate, you can see the next cycle beginning to appear at the poles with oppositely directed toroidal field. A half period later, you see the fields in much the same condition they were with reversed polarities for the poloidal field as well. The velocity field is a constant shear in the y direction. So there's a y-directed velocity field with a constant shear to it. Now, I could likewise plot the position of these maxima with time. And if I did that, I'd get a simple one-dimensional analog of a butterfly diagram where the dark crosses are positively directed toroidal field and the light marks are negatively directed toroidal field. So as you can see, over time, activity propagates toward what is the equivalent of the equator in the simple Cartesian model, so that you can see how the dynamo waves that are a product of this approach to the generation of the solar magnetic field gives rise to this propagation toward the equator from the poles and reproduces in some simple sense some of the properties, observed properties in the solar cycle. No. Well, as of about the middle 70s to late 80s, there were many models, mean field electrodynamic models available for the solar dynamo, and here's just one of them. It's not the most sophisticated one that was available, but it's a model in spherical geometry for the sun. On the left-hand side of each figure is depicted contours of constant toroidal field, solid being positive and the dashed being negative. And on the right-hand side are the poloidal field lines. And you can see that over the course of this cycle, the toroidal fields propagate toward the equator, and that you get a general reversal of the poloidal field. Yes?
I've always thought this was an interesting model because it has, if you look at the year 5 there, the beginning of an extended solar cycle. In other words, we saw this morning a very nice couple of illustrations of the extended solar cycle, how the two overlap. And it shows up in particularly in this model. To what extent today, knowing what we know, is this kind of thinking still valid?
This model, I think, by and large, has been superseded. It was based on the old Deinzer and Stix 1971 model. The model basically had simply a radial gradient and angular velocity in the sense that d omega dr was negative, that is, the angular velocity increased inward. It was concentrated at a single location, which was the interface between the convection zone and the underlying radiative interior. The alpha effect was in fact restricted to a finite region within the convection zone as well. The property of models like this is that the propagation of the dynamo wave is determined by alpha and the vector cross product of the gradient of omega, and in this case the unit vector in the azimuthal direction. It means that this model is guaranteed of having dynamo waves that propagate toward the equator, and whether that propagate latitudinally, whether or not they propagate toward the equator is simply a function of what the relative sign of alpha and d omega dr is. Right.
Showed that all along. It was puzzling. I mean, if we're studying observation.
Well, in this model, the sense of propagation of the dynamo wave with alpha varying like cosine theta and chosen to be positive in the northern hemisphere, then d omega dr needs to be negative in order for the dynamo wave to propagate toward the equator. Well, that's something of the status of dynamo theory toward the middle 70s. There are a number of developments that motivated dynamo theory off into different directions after that time. One was the effect of buoyancy on magnetic fields and flux tubes in magnetic field and flux tube form within the convection zone. Parker pointed out that the rise time of a flux tube in mechanical and thermal equilibrium was of order a month or so, far less than the time scale of the solar cycle, the 11-year solar cycle, so that the retention of flux required that the site of the dynamo be moved down to the subadiabatically stratified layers beneath the convection zone. Helioseismology showed that the angular velocity distribution within the sun was one in which the observed pattern of differential rotation with latitude and the surface persists along radii in the convection zone, transforming into a solid body rotation of the radiative interior. And the only significant vertical shear that's present is located within the tachocline, the thin layer that immediately underlays the bottom of the convection zone. And there, the sine of d omega dr is negative at polar latitudes, but is actually positive toward the equator. Studies of thin flux tube dynamics in three dimensions revealed that the latitude of emergence and tilt angle of flux at the surface depended strongly on what the strength of the field was, and argued that in order to get bipolar magnetic regions that emerge at the proper latitudes with the proper tilt, field strengths that were of order 10 to the 5 Gauss, which is as much as a factor of 10 in excess of equipartition with convective motions at the bottom of the convection zone were required. And finally, as we learned this morning, there's ample evidence for the existence of a large-scale meridional flow within the convection zone, which also has impacts for dynamo modeling. Well, there are several models that have been developed to cope with some of these difficulties, and I'm just going to briefly talk about two of them. One is a class of mean field dynamo models known as interface models, models in which the shear and alpha effect are spatially separated from one another. Rather than coexisting in the same volume of space, they're separated, and the region between them also undergoes a transition in magnetic diffusivity from a low value that's characteristic of the radiative interior of the sun to a higher value that might be associated with the turbulence in the convection zone. These models work because of characteristics of diffusion in a composite medium, in the sense that if we consider just the simple diffusion problem of a toroidally directed field in the medium with a transition in magnetic diffusivity, As the diffusivity ratio is stepped to larger and larger values, the gradient in BY with Z in the low diffusivity portion of the domain becomes steeper and steeper, basically as a consequence of enforcing the continuity of the tangential component of the electric field at this interface boundary. So for sufficiently large contrast in diffusivity from the bottom to the top half of the domain, you can start with a field which is comparable to equipartition at the bottom, but within the high diffusivity portion of the domain, where the alpha effect would presumably operate, you can have a low sub-equipartition value of the toroidal field, and therefore not impede the alpha effect. Now, there have been many models that have been calculated and investigated. A crucial property of these kinds of models is the necessity of the fields diffusing between the two source regions within the domain in order to complete the dynamo cycle. What typically happens is that toroidal field can be produced within a shear layer, which then must diffusively propagate to the alpha effect layer in order to regenerate the colloidal field. So there's a natural lag built into the models that's associated with this diffusion. I'll show you what happens when you apply such a model to the sun. This is a spherical model which has a solar-like internal differential rotation. The diffusivity contrast between the core and envelope was taken to be a tenth, and alpha was given the cosine distribution that was inferred from the interaction of Coriolis with convection. Here, what I've shown are simulated butterfly diagrams. The top is for the toroidal field, and the bottom is for the colloidal field. This is at the base of the convection zone. This is at the surface of the sun. You can see what happens in models like this. The toroidal field reverses polarity from minus to plus. Prior to the reversal in polarity at the poles of the colloidal field, but the colloidal field is pi out of phase in the sense that the sense of the polarity change is the opposite of what it's supposed to be. And not only that, the fields are strongly concentrated in the polar regions, and it comes from the fact that we've selected an angular distribution of alpha which is large in the poles, and it's coupled itself to the negative radial gradient of omega that exists there to make equatorward propagating dynamo waves. So we can rectify some of those characteristics by modifying the selections for input parameters. Here, again, we've adopted a model with a solar-like internal differential rotation. We've bumped the diffusivity ratio down by another factor of 10 and chosen an alpha distribution which is highly concentrated in the range between minus 45 and plus 45 degrees latitude. We've made alpha negative because the radial gradient of omega in the equatorial regions in the sun is positive. If alpha was chosen to be positive there, then the dynamo waves would propagate toward the poles. So we've selected alpha negative to make them propagate in the opposite sense. A negative alpha is the kind of thing you would get at the bottom of the convection zone, possibly, if you imagined a convective upwelling with, at its base, material converging into the base before rising so as to give a positive vorticity in the northern hemisphere. Here you can see... simply to concentrate it in the vicinity of the equator so that now everything happens largely between plus or minus 30 degrees latitude. The dynamo modes for the toroidal field propagate toward the equator.
Exactly.
in this case, it's simply a parameter specification. There's no more rationale for it than that. Simply to get it to operate the right way. Here, though, in the poloidal field, has developed a poleward propagating branch. And you can see that now the sign change between toroidal and poloidal fields has been rectified. Well, let me discuss an alternative to the interface mean field type dynamo. This is a model that's due to the phenomenological model of Babcock in 1961. Babcock envisaged the sun's magnetic field being regenerated in what was a four-step process. At the beginning of the cycle, the sun existed in a state with a purely poloidal field. In stage two, the sun's internal differential rotation sheared that poloidal field to create a toroidal field and wrapped and intensified the toroidal field through that process. He envisaged the differential rotation of the sun being kind of a restricted to the immediate surface layers of the solar interior and to have a negative gradient of omega with respect to R. In stage three, the strength of the field reached a critical level above which the field erupts in the form of bipolar magnetic regions, which have the opposite magnetic polarity in the two hemispheres. And in his model, the critical field strength for eruption of toroidal flux was achieved first at high latitudes and then subsequently at low latitudes to make the toroidal field propagate in the right direction. In stage four, the active regions that were created as a result of this inductive process begin to decay and dissipate. And his model, the active regions begin to diffuse. There's reconnection of fields across the equator to cancel out some of the flux from the leading spot of spot pairs in both hemispheres. And the following spots drift toward the pole in their respective hemispheres. And there's enough flux associated with that emerging spot pairs during the course of a cycle to cancel out the existing polarity of the poloidal field in both hemispheres. So at the end, you're left with a dipole field again, in this case, a poloidal field, but with the opposite polarity, and the cycle begins again. Now, Babcock's model was phenomenological, and it was quantified to some extent by Leighton. At roughly 10 years ago, the model was reconsidered by a variety of workers, by Wang and Sheely and Nash, by Arnab Chowdhury, Bernard Durney, and others, all of whom pointed out the importance of some processes that had not been included in either the Babcock or Leighton versions of the model, in particular the importance of meridional circulation. I'm going to just briefly summarize the behavior of one such model. It's a model that's due to Masumi Dikpati and Paul Charbonneau. Again, the induction equation is the starting point for the investigation. The internal velocity field is prescribed to be a solar-like internal differential rotation with a single meridional circulation cell existing. There's a source region for the poloidal field. That is, the induction equation can be split into poloidal and toroidal parts again. And in the poloidal component, there's a source for poloidal field, which is non-local, in the sense that it depends upon the strength of the toroidal field at the base of the convection zone. It's meant to simulate the rise of toroidal flux in the form of loops and the subsequent twist of the loops by the Coriolis force to create the poloidal component of the solar field. There's a quenching factor, which is to simulate the fact that for field strengths in excess of 100,000 gauss or so, the field is sufficiently strong that toroidal flux will rise nearly radially, will suffer very little deflection by the Coriolis force, so as to decrease the efficiency of production of colloidal field. So this model when applied with these parameters, a poleward poloidal meridional circulation with a characteristic speed of 15 meters per second at the surface gives rise to a butterfly diagram like this. Again, here's a toroidal field at the interface, the radial field at the surface. And here you can see that that the toroidal activity propagates towards the equator, as is required that the change in polarity here from negative to positive is followed at the right phase on this equatorward propagating branch in the same sense in the poloidal field. So it gets the phase between the poloidal and toroidal fields properly, and it makes the change at about the time of solar maximum, that is, the time where you achieve the strongest toroidal field. From a parameter study, they found that the dependence of dynamo period on input parameters was something like this. So the dynamo period is only weakly dependent on the strength of the poloidal source term and on the diffusivity of the envelope, and has its strongest dependence on the characteristic speed of circulation. So in fact, the period of this dynamo is determined by the period of the circulatory flow field within the convective envelope. And you can see kind of how that works here. On the left is a toroidal field. On the right is the poloidal field. Again, these are contours of constant toroidal field. Here are the poloidal field lines. And you can see how at the beginning of this period that's depicted, the poloidal field at the poles is positive. But the poleward circulatory flow advects this negative directed field in such a way as to wipe out and reverse the polarity of the pole. And then subsequently, the circulation subducts the poloidal field deep and down, where the return flow begins to stretch it and twist it in such a way that it provides the poloidal field for the vertical shear to act on to begin to generate the toroidal field associated with the next phase. And that stretching creates these layers of alternating polarity that are very closely packed at the bottom of the convection zone. Their opposite polarity of toroidal field and enhances the rate of dissipation of the field from old cycles so as to get rid of it. Well, I'm nearly out of time, so let me just conclude by offering a comparison between the two different types of models. Interface models, mean field electrodynamic type models on the one hand, and Babcock-Leighton models on the other. Both of them, with sufficient twisting, can account for some of the basic solar cycle features. The interface model can cope with having an operative alpha effect even when the toroidal field within the shear layer exceeds equipartition value just by the spatial separation of the alpha and omega effects and the transition in magnetic diffusivity between those two regions. There are a variety of sources that could possibly be tapped for an alpha effect, in the sense that traditionally it's been supposed that helical convection supplies the alpha effect, but as my colleague Peter Gilman pointed out this morning, instability in the tachocline in three dimensions may give rise to helical motions of the right source to make an alpha effect as well. In Babcock-Leighton models, an interesting feature is the fact that strong fields are actually required for the dynamo to operate. It's not necessarily a disadvantage to have strong fields because it's a requirement of the model. The model is extremely robust. The period of the dynamo is set by the circulation speed, and Charbonneau and Dick Potty have investigated the effect of fluctuations in all these quantities on the phase coherence and the periodicity of the dynamo. And because and it's extremely stable, so it's desirable in that aspect. And it does, in fact, give the correct phase between the reversals of poloidal and toroidal fields. And in fact, it reverses the poloidal field at the time of sunspot maximum. On the demerit side, both models are kinematic, and it's something that's going to have to be addressed in the future. It's well known the problems with kinematic descriptions of the alpha effect. In the Babcock-Layton case, there are strong fields generated at the base of the convection zone, strong enough, it would appear at least, to partially interfere with even the circulatory flow fields itself. So that's going to have to be addressed. There are many questions about the applicability of mean field theory. In the interface models, in order to get phases properly and right periods and behavior, the parameters really have to be fine-tuned in a way that makes you question the robustness of the theory. Not only that, I didn't show you results for nonlinear versions of the theory, but the nonlinear version of the model is extremely easily disrupted in a way that that makes you wonder about the viability of the model as applied to the real solar cycle. On the Babcock-Layton side, the model is not self-excited. It requires a strong field to be there in order for it to work to begin with. So one wonders, for example, if there were an extended period of Maunder minimum or something like this, how would it kick in to resume? The poloidal fields in the polar regions that I showed you in the previous view graph are very strong. In fact, for that solar model, they're 140 Gauss. And the reason for that is because they're advected poleward by the circulatory flow, which is a convergent flow, so that they're intensified just by flux conservation as the flow reaches the pole and begins to go under. So I'm not sure how to correct that apart from changing the geometry of the circulatory flow in the polar regions. And finally, the poloidal source term itself is an important component of the theory, and as it stands, is a schematic attempt to reproduce some of the physical attributes of the supposed source of poloidal field, but needs to be looked into in more detail. So I'll stop there. That's what in Paul and Masumi investigated the effect of fluctuations in each of the three parameters that I enumerated, how the dynamo behaves. So you could imagine, for example, fluctuating the circulatory flow speed by as much as 10 or 20 or more percent. And that then introduces a corresponding change into the period of the dynamo as well. The same kind of effect actually happens in the interface type models as well. You know, there's been considerable interest among some people in the dynamo modeling community about fluctuations in alpha. And if you look at the consequences of fluctuations in alpha for an interface model, you can get changes of the same sort, fluctuations in the dynamo period, that are the result of fluctuating the magnitude of alpha around. In a sense, that the period depends upon the square root of alpha in those mean field. I mean, it varies roughly like the square root of alpha in those mean field models. So if you fluctuate the magnitude of alpha, you get a corresponding change in the period as well. But it's generally less responsive to changes in some of its physical quantities than the Babcock-Layton model is.
The question I had with Artie Sharp in the picture, if I had a long cycle versus a short cycle, is there some other manifestation that we can go back and look at in the sunspot numbers, scores, distribution, et cetera, that would help us to validate that too?
Offhand, I can't, if you let me think about it for a while, maybe I'll tell, but offhand, the quantity most directly affected is the period itself, and the period is interesting in the sense that it has a weak dependence on the strength of the poloidal source term, which, despite my criticism of it as being schematic, it's actually in some sense a strength of the theory, because it means you don't have to get it so accurately and still get kind of the right general behavior. The period is most strongly dependent on kind of the amplitude of the circulatory flow field, and it's variations in that that would lead to variations in the period. And what you can say, I mean, we heard some evidence this morning that the circulatory flow, meridional flow, may be variable at a given time in a given place. If you look at some of the three-dimensional rotating convection simulations that Mark Miesch has done, those are characterized, those have meridional circulation that arises naturally within them. In the surface layers, they tend to be very episodic and transitory, and that's the kind of thing that would manifest itself as a fluctuation in the period from cycle to cycle.
Okay.